Welcome to Rhode Island Avenue Radio, where we'll talk about news, education, and opportunities for small businesses on the Rhode Island Avenue Main Street and in Washington, D.C. I'm Michelle Yancey.
And I'm Kyle Todd. Welcome to Rhode Island Avenue Radio.
Welcome, Dr. Griffiths. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about your dental practice.
Well, my practice is geared toward all patients, aesthetics and general dentistry. It's also geared specifically because I chose to gear it toward the elderly and the people that can't get to a dentist generally. So we have a combined practice of one that provides care to the patients that can get to us and patients that can't get to us.
So that certainly makes this dental practice different from other practices. Do you offer any unique services?
Yes, through our mobile dental services, we can actually come to your home and provide dental care. Through our in-house dental services, we can provide the full range of dental services. And the mobile dental services, we're one of the only people in the district that can actually take x-rays and do advanced procedures out in the field, which we've done plenty of times.
So not actually in the person's house, but a mobile vehicle?
No. I don't believe in the mobile vehicles because the mobile vehicles still say, I got to get grandma out of bed and drag
her
outside.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. Okay.
Yeah, that never made any sense to me.
Okay.
So,
you drive and go
inside the home.
Okay.
Yeah, I worked in a mobile van out in California, which is probably the best weather for that.
Right.
And that was with migrant farm worker kids out there when I was in training.
So what kind of procedures can you do in the home?
We can do all procedures. We've even done implants and root canals and fillings, of course, crowns. We've done pretty much everything that you can imagine.
What about your nursing home services? I understand that you...
Yes, we provide services in nursing homes. We've provided services to the Washington Center for Aging up here for a number of years. And then due to changes in administration, we're not there at this present time. But we were the first provider when the home was taken over by the D.C. government in the early 1980s.
So where did you go to dental school?
I went to the University of Michigan. Go Blue.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I went to Michigan State also, undergrad, and that's Go Green, Go White. So
what made you decide to take over your dad's business? I mean, I know that sounds like a silly question, but...
Well, that wasn't the plan originally.
Okay.
My father was here practicing and doing quite well and happy to be here. And unfortunately, he passed away in 1976, which was... end of my second year. And I ended up coming back here, helping my mother take over, you know, and move things around and stuff like that. And I decided to come back here and make this my home and practice here.
And you've been practicing here for how long?
About 38 years.
Wow. So I understand that you used to teach at Howard University. Can you tell us when and tell us about that time?
Yeah, I taught at Howard University for about 16 years. I taught in the Department of Community Health and Family Practice, which most people's eyes, brows raise, well, didn't you teach in the dental school? I said, no, I never taught in the dental school. I taught in the areas of public health and advanced biostatistics and epidemiology. So I taught people how to do research. And I also taught Introduction to Patient Care 1, 2, 3, and 4 for the undergraduate medical students.
So it sounds like you definitely believe that there, which I do too, there's a correlation between dental health and overall physical health, like we were talking about.
Yes.
So your practice is not a new business.
No,
clearly.
It's not.
It's not a new business.
It's been here a while.
Right. How have you been able to maintain and grow your dental practice over all of these years?
Well, we try to provide quality work to people that's patient-centered as opposed to centered on what the business is. Of the practice, and I think that's the biggest difference that we try to exhibit with our patients, because I think that we've had numerous patients here that are luminaries in the city and former presidents of Howard University and other university professors and stuff like that. So we try to give patients a reason to come here that is other than just getting their teeth clean.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So going to the dentist is very expensive, as we know.
Yes.
Do you all offer any type of payment plans or dental insurance? Do you take dental insurance?
We take some dental insurances, mm-hmm. and we also provide access to care credit, which is a big funding thing for cosmetic and restorative procedures that are not covered by insurance. So we offer all the varieties, and of course the usual, you know, MasterCard, Visa, and all that
right.
stuff.
So some people are afraid of going to the dentist, as you know.
I haven't met any patient that came in here and said they were not afraid of going
right.
to the dentist.
Right.
So that's kind of the norm. And what I would suggest is that we try to be friendly to the patients to the point that they kind of will let us do what we need to do. And that is usually just a matter of just being human to the patient. And I think that's the most important thing, whether it be a little kid or whether it be a 80, 90-year-old person that's sitting in my chair. And we treat patients that are over 100, so
wow.
I don't find any problems with them. Well, first of all, the older patients, I act like I'm their kid, and they
probably
accept
treat
that.
You like you're their kid.
And they accept that, yeah. and they are appreciative of that. And I also try to explain things to them in English, so I'm not using researchees. And I think that's kind of disarming. It's like when the guy tells you about your car, what he has to do to it, and you just look at him and say, what the hell did he just say?
Right, right.
I fortunately know a little bit about cars, but I probably know a little bit more about cars than people know about their bodies. So.
Right, right. So what are your normal business hours, and do you provide services for emergencies?
We do provide services for emergencies, patients of records. In terms of that, we will normally talk to our patients. I had a patient call just the other day when I was in Colorado, and he had a problem that he hadn't been back in to see about, and it wasn't a problem when he came to the office. And we took care of him over the phone, and with working with his pharmacist, and we took care of that problem pretty quickly.
Great. What about normal business hours?
Normal business hours are 9 to 5, and we work pretty much all.
That's like Monday through Friday.
Monday through Friday.
Monday
yeah.
through Friday. And do you have specific times where you go out mobily?
Yes, usually
days?
On days like today.
Ah, okay. All right.
But we go out other days also. It
so on a Tuesday or yeah. Wednesday, you would.
Yeah, it depends on what the patient needs are and what our clinical hours are here in the office. So if we have some time free, we could get out there and see you. We have numerous patients in Virginia, Manassas, Maryland.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we go wherever the patients need us.
Even with the nursing homes, you'll go out to Maryland and Virginia?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see anything new for the practice in the future?
That's an interesting thing. There are a lot of opportunities, I think, for us to increase things that we do in the dental office.
Mm-hmm.
Things that were not done when I finished school, like the whole area of Botox and cosmetic sort of facial features, they weren't taught to anybody that came through when I came through because
mm-hmm.
they weren't available.
Right.
So physicians and dentists have learned how to do some of those procedures. I have my ideas about Botox. I think it can work, and I think it should be able to work. I'd like
in
to be
conjunction
more
with dentistry.
Yeah,
Botox.
I think it needs to be. I think it needs to be a little bit more directed. And I'm working with actually my sister who does Botox
uh-huh.
to see if I can come up with a better idea of how to do it correctly and predictably. I think that's the biggest problem. I think a lot of times we do things that are unpredictable in medicine,
mm-hmm.
and the patient
don't get the results that you were looking for.
And then the patient kind of says, "Well, what does this look like now?"
Mm-hmm.
And I think with our video capabilities and our projection capabilities, I think we can do a better job.
So Dr. Griffiths, tell us about some of the other unique services that you offer. You offer quite a few, from my understanding.
Yes, we offer dental care to the special needs clients, including those with memory disorders such as Alzheimer's and those that have mental disorders such as special needs clients. And we've been doing that for pretty much 35, 40 years.
Well, that must present some unique challenges to see a patient that may or may not remember you from visit to visit?
That is the challenge, and we try to encourage the caregiver or the family member, whoever brings the patient in, to bring them in a minimum of 4 times a year so that we can sort of get
maintain
some
a
sort
relationship.
Of maintain
also.
A relationship. And we have a really good time with them. I mean, some of them actually do remember me, and they say, hey, I don't remember anything else, but I remember Dr. Griffiths.
That's great.
I say, well, that's great, you know, and I must thank my friend and colleague, Dr. Reed Tuckson. He was head of the mental health services here in the district before, way back when in the 80s, and he referred him to me and begged me to take him. And I said, okay, Reed, that's because we're friends, but that's it.
So
I really enjoyed it.
You're the only dentist in this practice.
There are a couple other dentists that have been in and out of the practice,
okay.
But I'm the only dentist at this present
currently.
Time.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. We've had, I've been fortunate enough to train other dentists in doing this, and I used to be on the board of directors of the American Society for Geriatric Dentistry. That was, again, back in the 80s. Am I giving away my age?
A little bit, but that's all right. With age comes wisdom, right?
Yeah.
That's what they say.
Yeah.
So I think so. I think it takes a special person to handle patients with disabilities.
Yeah,
certainly.
I enjoy those.
That's
really
great.
Those are the fun patients.
And you said that you take patients of all ages, so children. You mentioned
yes.
A 100-year-old patient.
Yes, children. We take all the children, and it's basically gaining the trust of the patient. And I think once you gain the trust of the patient, we had a mother bring her child in before that had been going to a relative of hers, and I said, okay, well, let me get this thing done. So I examined her as much as I could, and I said, okay, well, you can leave now. And then the mother called back and said, well, you didn't really look at her very well. I said, well, I'm not going to traumatize this little girl.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to happen. I said, but bring her back anytime, home from school, going to the, you know, get her hair cut, whatever, and I'll look at her again, and I'll verify what the heck I put on her paperwork for school. But I wanted her to make sure that she could attend school. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
D.C. government has a requirement that all kids attend school, have a dental exam.
Yes.
So I think that's important. And I think I can measure out that dental exam 2 or 3 visits and still get it done. And usually most kids nowadays do not have the dental cavities that we had, you know, say when I was growing up, or
yes, back.
Like that.
I remember when I was growing up, it seemed like going to the dentist was sort of optional, an afterthought.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be that way.
No, it should never be an afterthought. Because one thing that I will tell anybody that has children is that bring them in early,
yes,
before anything goes wrong.
Yes.
And get them to be familiar with the dental environment, and it's really not that difficult. And don't bring them in when you see a crooked tooth and say, oh, now I want them to see an orthodontist.
Right.
It's kind of like they don't want to see any of us at all, but they certainly don't want to see somebody that's going to be taking impressions and that type of thing first time.
As the first visit.
No.
Right.
No, you don't want
right.
to do that. So I think that it's very important to bring the patient in early if you're in charge of the patient, and that is for children and for the elderly, the 102-year-old, 110-year-olds that I have in the practice are all treated the same way. We try to maintain a relationship with them, which I think is a key thing to any type of health care, but especially dental care, because it's kind of invasive.
Right, and the earlier you see them, the longer they can have their real teeth. Right?
Well, that's the idea.
That's the idea.
And the whole thing is that, you know, now I think people are getting a little, you know, like, oh, well, we can always put an implant in. Well, not really.
Right.
There are a lot
that should be a last resort, not the go-to resort.
Right. And I think too many people are kind of, I have patients that stop me on the street and ask me, can you put an implant in here? And I'm like, well, I don't know. There are a lot of medical conditions that compromise a patient's health that would say, and it's not something that you would normally think of, but they need to be evaluated before you do implants on patients.
Mm-hmm.
And I am very cautious about that now, because like you said, that wisdom, a few things come with that wisdom, and it can be given out easily.
Right. So if our listeners want to find out more about your practice, where can they go to find the information?
They can go to our website, www.dentaldc.com, and they can find out everything about us.
Great.
And, probably more things than I want to tell you, but
And the physical address of Dr. Griffith is 3100 20th Street Northeast at the corner of 20th and Rhode Island. Thank you, Dr. Griffiths, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Hey, welcome back to the second half of Rhode Island Avenue Radio. Before we get to our next guest, I want to give a big shout out to our sponsors again, the Department of Small and Local Business Development here in D.C. and the Department of Housing and Community Development here in D.C. Could not do this radio show without their sponsorship, so thank you very much. This is Patrice Fry, and I'm going to have a little bit of a fanboy moment. Patrice is the president and CEO of, and I'm going to mess this up again, the National Main Streets Program. National Main Street Center. I was at the National Main Street Conference the year that she was announced as the new president and CEO. I saw her last year speaking. And Patrice, you were here in town for a coordinators meeting, National State Coordinators meeting. And I could not believe my luck to get you to sit down and talk with us. So thank you.
Kyle, it's a mutual admiration society because I'm always in awe of the work that Main Street managers do on the ground each and every day to create better and stronger places that are, really reflect the values of the community and serve the community. So back at you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Again, fanboy moment, I'm not even going to know really where to start other than the fact that the Main Street approach has metamorphosized.
Mm-hmm.
It's grown and developed.
Sure.
You guys are rolling out what you're calling a beta launch of the refreshed Main Street approach.
That's right.
Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, so for those of your listeners who are maybe a little bit less familiar with Main Street, our work started 35 years ago as a program of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and we are now a subsidiary of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. But really, the work started, it's premised on the idea that we can see great things in our communities when we put older and historic buildings back into use and in service of their communities. So over the last 35 years, Main Street has been unquestionably the most successful local economic development program in the country. We've had more than 2,000 communities participate. We've seen investments in downtowns and neighborhood commercial district up north of $60 billion, which is, is an impressive number. And I think it's all the more impressive when you think about a lot of the places where Main Street has worked have been incredibly distressed areas that have faced massive, very significant disinvestment. So we're incredibly proud of the program. Now, the program is really structured on something we've called the four-point approach. And we're changing our terminology a little bit. But that four-point approach is really designed to help community leaders along with volunteers, organized to create a successful downtown transformation. And premise it with the four elements, of course, are design, which is in recognition of the fact that quality design matters. And of course, a lot of what we emphasize in Main Street is making the most of those older and historic buildings.
Right.
That's certainly not all of it, though. The streetscape is very important. Connectivity and transportation issues, especially in major urban areas that you see, is of course super important. Organization is one of the other elements, and that is just an acknowledgement that it's hard to have a successful commercial revitalization effort if you don't have a really strong organization behind that effort. And in most instances, great places don't just happen. It takes takes some real organizational know-how and sustainability, which involves professional management, but also extensive engagement of the community. Promotions, we talk a lot about promotions in Main Street because it's a basic element, right? It's marketing.
Right.
It's getting the word out there that this this district is open for business. It's an exciting place to be. There are all kinds of services and retail and dining opportunities for folks. So that's traditionally been an incredibly important part of Main Street. And then last, and certainly not least, maybe in many ways the most important element, is economic restructuring, which under the new Main Street, and I'll get to that in a second, under a new Main Street, we've actually changed the name of that term, the name of that point, if you will, because I think it's been a little bit confusing to people. But it is basically the understanding that you have to work with the assets you have. You have to understand the overall market in which you work, the overall market context, and make some really strategic decisions about what kind of district you want to be and line up your work around that. So that's a lot about business retention. It's a lot about business recruitment. Certainly, and this is not just in urban areas, but we see this in small towns. You know, downtown neighborhood commercial districts aren't just about commercial, retail, or office. They are about residential. And so we're seeing that come into play more of our Main Streets. So we have that as an incredibly successful backdrop. But we felt, 35 years in, that this was an important moment to reflect on all that we have learned from these 3+ decades of experience and think about how where there were opportunities for improvement. And so that's where the Main Street refresh, which is how we're referred to, that's really the genesis of the refresh. And I'm happy to provide a little bit more detail on that as well. Some of the challenges that we were seeing with use of the four-point approach were that traditionally Main Street had encouraged organizations to align themselves, to organize their committee work and their activities really along each of these 4 points. So along design, organization, promotions, economic restructuring. And what we saw was that sometimes that allowed enabled work to become very siloed, right? So a committee would become very, very, very focused on its promotions, right? Maybe you have a few annual events that you do, or the design committee might become very, very focused on a facade improvement program.
Right.
But what would sometimes be missing, not always the case, but sometimes be missing, is an overall sense of, what is the vision for this community?
The big picture.
The big picture. What's the big picture for this community? And how can we make sure that the work we're doing in each of these areas really aligns with that vision, really moves the needle with that vision? So the new Refresh Main Street approach is, there are a few elements of it, but in general, I talk about it being more strategic. It's more flexible, and it's more outcome-oriented. And so in terms of being strategic, what we mean by that is what we're asking communities to do now with this new approach, which, as you mentioned, Kyle, is in beta version, so we're testing it over the next year, and Main Streeters will see lots more information about this within the next 12 to 18 months. But what we're asking communities to do is to really take a step back, look, understand what they're engaged with their community, understand what the community wants from that district. Look at the market data. What is that market data telling you? You might want to be an arts and entertainment district, but if you don't have any galleries and you don't have any space that really is suited to that, if you don't have any theaters, you're starting at a disadvantage there. So maybe that's not the best place for your community to start. So understand what that vision is. Have a reality check in terms of understanding some of the local market dynamics. And then from there, work on the overall vision of what it is. I always, my shorthand for this is, what do you want to be when you grow up, right? You have to have that vision of your end game.
Yeah.
So that can take lots of different forms. You can be a very successful district that serves local residents and convenience oriented for serving local residents, local office workers. You could be a district that really focuses on being elderly friendly and focuses on elder care, and actually the way demographics are shifting in this country, that can be an incredibly successful strategy. That's right. So then once you understand that, once you have that, what we call the transformation strategy, community transformation strategy, and there may be more than one or two, then it's a question of, well, how does that line up with the 4 points? What are you doing in design to support this, let's say you have a vision of being a community that does support, boomers and elderly housing and creates a really safe, accessible environment. Well, what do you have in terms of building stock? Who do you need to be working with? Who are the developers? What are the, what can you be bringing to the table as a main street to help incentivize those developments to help make that work happen? And then really, again, thinking across all dimensions of the 4 points in terms of putting that strategy into place. And then the last thing that I'll mention, which is really important, is outcome measurement. And I think Main Street has been very smart over the last 30 years in really tracking reinvestment statistics, how many buildings are rehabilitated in each of our main streets, how many jobs are created, how many net new businesses, how much overall investment is taking place. And I think there's a need. We're sort of working in a world now in which people who fund us are hyper focused on measuring our outcomes, and they want us to be able to articulate what precisely Main Street was able to accomplish and why Main Street continues to be worthy of investment, whether it's investment from the city, from local sponsors, from foundations, it can come from any number of sources. And so to be really mindful at the outset about, okay, how are we going to measure our success here? What does that look like for us? And over the next 12 to 18 months, we'll be rolling out tools that better enable communities to make, to help measure those, their progress along the way.
I think having those tools roll out is so important, because otherwise you may be doing quantitative analysis, but you're getting so many different versions of it.
That's right. So a kind of a baseline level for everyone, how to measure change over time, because that's really what we're trying to do. And I think it is a mixture of both quantitative and qualitative. And sometimes we see people really fixate on the quantitative piece, which is incredibly important. You have to understand the economic impact of what you're doing. You need to understand the fiscal impact of what you're doing, the benefit to the city. But we're all human beings, and there are elements of what we do that are very, very powerful in terms of transforming communities, helping people feel more connected to their communities, safer in their communities. And those things can be harder to quantify, but are just as important. So it's really capturing both.
Absolutely. Perception, feelings, that's everything, really.
Yeah.
So latching on to that quantitative versus qualitative, I was reading through the beta approach overview, and there's mention of this being both art and science.
Yeah.
You want to elaborate a little bit more on that?
Sure.
Obviously, it links into the qualitative versus quantitative.
Yeah, it does. And so I think you can think of art and science having a role at different places in the process, probably every place in the process. But one of the most powerful things about Main Street is Main Street can serve as a forum to engage the community. And the best Main Streets do exactly that. The best Main Streets don't come in and say, hey, we want to do this. This is our vision as the organization. They really work with the community to understand what the community wants,
right?
As they should, right? And that's a little bit of art, right? Because that community engagement process is that's not necessarily a strict science, but it's such in that participation, that engagement, that collaboration is such an important part of the project, that process rather. The science is a little bit more the market analysis, right? There is, you probably don't want a market analysis that's too artful. You want a market analysis that really tells you what the opportunities are in your district, what the needs are in the district. And so you have to take very seriously that you need some real quantitative data informing your decision making. And then, if you think about it at the end of the process, that art and science is there as well, just in terms of describing the impacts of your community, of your work, the impacts to your community and of your work in a way that tells a powerful story and engages people and really drives them to support you. But again, the science and measuring outcomes, you have to have a rigorous process that helps you say, this is where we started, this is where we ended, and it was because of Main Street that we saw these successful outcomes.
So, I'm thinking about community vision versus market understanding. Let's say a Main Street program has the opportunity to have a very robust market analysis provided to them.
Yeah.
And let's say that same Main Street program has a community that is not the least bit shy about sharing a vision.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do those things in tandem and hope that they work out together at the same
sure,
place?
Sure.
Or do you do market analysis first and say, hey, community, this is what the market analysis looks like. What do you want to do with that? Or the opposite. What do you suggest on that?
Well, I think ideally you're doing both concurrently. So maybe you're having a community session where you're going in and you're just doing pure brainstorming, pure intel gathering from the community, feelings, right, perceptions, what they want this place to be. And in a way, I think you don't want to color that maybe at first blush with the market realities of the community. But I think it's incredibly powerful to understand what their priorities are, what their vision is. And then at the same time, very soon after that, you do the market analysis. I mean, I think in reality, it doesn't always work out where you're able to do things sequentially. And then go back to the community and say, this is what we heard from you. This is where the vision really aligns with what the market analysis is telling us. And maybe here are where there's some tension points. And obviously, decision makers are going to have to mediate between those two things, what the vision is and what the and the community needs to mediate between those two things, what the vision is and what the market data tells them.
So you mentioned earlier that some of the one of the four point approach markers, economic restructuring, have been revised a little bit,
right,
to economic vitality.
That's right, because economic restructuring, I think you mentioned, people thought maybe we were, that conjures up images of debt restructuring,
yes,
and financial restructuring, right, which was, bottom line, it's not a term that's meaningful to many people. And so we wanted to rename that as part of this process to economic vitality, because we think that term does have resonance. Everybody has a vision of what a vital district looks like,
right,
what a vital district in their community looks like, and so understanding the economic piece of it, that is incredibly important.
I confess that as much of the Main Street Kool-Aid as I have consumed, that phrase I always avoided using. Economic restructuring. We refer to it as economic revitalization or economic development, right? Just anything. Because we got so much pushback from community members at the very beginning.
Yeah, who don't know what it means. And, I think there are programs all across the country that did the same thing, where they would even rename it. I think some people call it economic development. So people had sort of altered it to serve their purposes over the years, which I completely understand.
And I cannot tell you how... I give this my stamp of approval. Not that that matters, but I'm really excited about this new beta launch of this, because, I not so humbly say that I feel like this is sort of the approach that we took when we got started.
Yes.
Before we even applied to be a part of the Main Street program, we did outreach to the community. We had a couple of big community meetings.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, our neighborhood, we got opinions. And you know, we had upwards of 80 people show up at our first community meeting to tell us what they wanted. And I've seen so many events happen where other programs, not other mainstream programs here, but just other operations, other programs have come in and told the community what's going to happen,
yes,
as opposed to asking them what they would like to have happen. And it just never goes well. And so I'm really thrilled that there is, it looks like there's going to be a much deeper understanding of community encouraged.
Yeah, and I think I'm glad you raised that, because the community engagement piece it can't be underestimated. It is so important. You know, it's so vital to people buying in and supporting, and ultimately having a community that reflects their wishes, their desires.
And it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that comes more organically in perhaps some of the small rural main streets.
Yeah.
Everybody knows everybody.
Yes.
Everybody is everybody's neighbor. And so it's almost an organic happening.
Right.
But maybe in the more urban settings where people don't necessarily know their next-door neighbor,
yep,
or the people across the street, it's a little bit harder to get that.
It can be harder to get that participation. There's no question. But in a way, you know, makes it all the more important. And I think it's to DC Main Street's credit that you all have focused so much on the community engagement piece. You know, this isn't new for you guys at all. This is just you know, sort of re-emphasizing what we at the National Main Street Center understand to be so important as part of the process.
So, how do you see differences between urban and more small-town Main Street programs?
Yeah, well, I think you just hit on one of them, which is that, you know, if you're in a community of 2,000 people, it can be, it often, you know, there are fewer things competing for the interests of those community members, so it can be easier to engage them. So I think there's no question that the engagement piece can be a little bit more challenging here in the urban areas. Not impossible, it can absolutely be done, but you know, it takes a little bit more push, maybe a few more meetings than you might need to have in a small community, that kind of thing. You know, the other thing that we've seen, and when I talk about the new 4-point refresh being more flexible, one of the major things is Main Street used to emphasize that each of your committees needed to be aligned with the 4 points. And I think, especially in urban areas, especially where we see more millennial engagement, that's not the way that folks are tending to want to organize themselves now.
Right.
Right. And so when we talk about the new approach being more flexible, part of that is go straight to organization, how you organize yourself. You know, If you tell me that you organize your committees in Rhode Island along the 4 points, that it was working for you, that's great. But we also want to provide the latitude, the flexibility to say, you know what, if that doesn't work for you, if people want to be organized around projects instead, if they want to be organized around transformation strategies instead, that is just fine. I hate to generalize, especially because we're still learning about this, but I think maybe in more rural areas that 4-committee model holds up a little bit better. I'm not entirely sure of that, but that could be one difference we see. You know, and I think there's a competition for resources in urban areas that it doesn't exist as in such a kind of exaggerated way in smaller rural communities. And that makes outcome measurement for urban communities, really sophisticated outcome measurement, all the more important, because you really got to make your case, and you're vying with lots of other really worthy organizations and operations for funding, and you know, just the complexity of the issues that urban areas deal with, you know, transportation planning, addressing just incredibly significant decades of disinvestment in large swaths of the city.
Right.
You know, that doesn't necessarily, that may exist in a more concentrated way in smaller rural communities. So that's, all of the refresh is really meant to help, again, communities be more strategic with their focus, but more flexible with how they're organizing themselves.
I think that's fantastic. I think you're absolutely right about getting millennials involved. I know in our neighborhood, we have a lot more success with recruiting volunteers to work on a project.
Yes, that's right.
And they don't want to come sit in a committee meeting. They don't want to work on a project.
Right, exactly. And maybe they come back and it's continuous engagement, or maybe there's just a particular project that really catches their fancy, and it means that I think you have to have a wider pool of volunteers that you recruit from than maybe in the past, which is just part of how organizations have to evolve.
It's always a new day. It's always a new day. So you've now been with National Main Street's Center for
2.5 years.
What brought you to these parts?
Sure. Well, I mentioned that our parent organization is the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and so I started out with the National Trust, and I worked on their sustainability program and helped to open a program office of theirs called the Preservation Green Lab, and which was really focused on how do we help people promote the reuse of older and historic buildings as part of overall efforts to address environmental conservation issues, and how do we encourage retrofits, greening of older and historic buildings. We also did a lot of your behalf of work around just sustainable communities in general, and so it was actually a very short leap between that set of issues and Main Street, because in the end it's all about creating more sustainable, better places for people, and doing that through reusing older buildings.
What is more sustainable? What is a more sustainable community than one where you can walk to everywhere you need to go and get all of your stuff right there?
Absolutely.
I love that. And I got to tell you, when you were announced, and I remember them announcing you as having been involved with the Green Lab, and my background is in environmental science.
Oh,
I was very
great.
Excited
yeah,
about that.
Yeah.
If the Department of Energy and Environment Director Tommy Wells is ever listening to this, we do want to be the green gateway into D.C. So,
yeah.
Just hint, hint.
Yeah.
We would love that. We've got a brand new restaurant that's open, and they just installed solar panels on the roof. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we hope we can encourage other businesses to engage
right.
in similar activities.
I personally can't imagine an environmentally sustainable future without strong local communities and strong local commercial districts.
Right.
Because it really takes being able to get out of your car and walk locally to take care of, say 80% of your needs, your basic needs, day to day, week to week. So that definitely is that sustainability element is a very powerful string that runs right through Main Street.
And I could spin off of this, and we could talk about this for another hour, as far as I'm concerned. But I know you've got a ton of meetings to hit today. Thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure to be.
It has been a total honor to have you sit down and talk with us, and I'm really looking forward to this rollout over the next year. Also looking forward to the Main Street Academy that I've just been reading about. We'll talk about that in another
Institute. Yes.
Yes, very excited about that. So Patrice Fry, President and CEO of the National Main Street Center, Main Street Approach now.
Yes.
Thank you again for joining us, and I'll see you at the Main Street's conference in Milwaukee.
Sounds great. I'll see you there. Thanks,
right.
Kyle.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was fantastic. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much.
Would that be helpful for
Absolutely.
Training? Okay.
Okay, absolutely. Good. And then Matt said that I'll be in touch with him next week.
Great.
When everyone's had a chance to decompress.
Right.
And we'll work out in the spring. And talking about what now everybody knows, the Main Street Academy, thanks to Kyle. Woo! I'm a certified Main Street manager, as is Anne Rosaline. But we're both going to go back for additional certification.
Great.
And I think we have two, possibly three EDs that want to go all the way.
Oh, that's
so
great.
So I think...
that's great.
Yeah. I was actually... When did I get certified? 2004, maybe?
Yeah, okay.
So it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I've always pushed for what I call continuing education.
Yeah.
And because it's a requirement here, I keep saying, why am I taking something I don't care for just because I need to have something every year? And I've been pushing and pushing and saying it's either planning, historic preservation based, or possibly Main
right.
Street based. And you guys answered all my prayers because finally I have something that I can enjoy. So, definitely looking forward to that.
Up. It opens, it'll open in about 2 weeks.
I know, so. I'm trying to get my director to sign off on
That's
it.
Great.
And then, but it'll be exciting also because so many of my colleagues will be there with me.
Yeah.
And that speaks again to the strength of DC Main Street. We have, out of seven directors that we have right now, one has been around for 10 years, one for 13 years, one for 7 years. One is a repeat offender, Bill McLeod.
Oh, sure.
Because he went to sit for 3 years and came back.
Wow.
So he also has, he's been with DuPont Circle 2 years. He was with Barrett's Row for 4 years. Mm-hmm. So we have, usually we retain our executive directors.
Yeah. Well, that says a lot about your program because a lot programs are not able to, it's just hard.
My biggest concern is burnout, and that's why I chase them, especially Kyle. we try to balance it, and we try to provide all the support that we can, given that it's me plus Lauren. But it's a wonderful team, and we really are looking forward to growing it through these tools, because what better way to learn than having a structured environment that gives us the flexibility, webinars, attend, talk to the experts.
Good. Okay. Glad to hear it. Really glad to hear it.